Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. Back in March, Eliot Spitzer was forced to resign his post as governor of the state of New York when it was revealed that he'd had been a regular client of a high-priced prostitution service. People who study the sex trade say that, in addition to paying for sex, clients at this level are also paying for privacy. Unlike Spitzer, most of them are never caught, and if they are, their names never become public. Perhaps the only thing about the Spitzer case that was rare is that, in fact, he was caught. This case and the attention that it got opened a door into a world that most people never see, and in many people's minds, certainly, raised many questions about those who pay for sex and about those who sell it. This morning, we'll be talking about prostitution in this hour of focus with Elizabeth Bernstein. She's assistant professor of women's studies and sociology at Barnard College, Columbia University in New York. And among her research interests are gender and sexuality. She's written several books that touch on this subject, including Temporarily Yours, Intimacy, Authenticity, and the Commerce of Sex, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2007. She was also the editor, co-editor of a book, Regulating Sex, The Politics of Intimacy and Identity, and is also working on one now in the working title, Creating Modern-Day Slavery, The Traffic in Bodies, Desires, and Social Policies at Century's End. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their questions and comments brief so that we can keep moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening and wants to join the conversation is welcome to do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that would mean that if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the Internet, use that toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you're certainly welcome to pick up the telephone and join in the conversation. Professor Bernstein, hello.
Hello, hi. Hi, David.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. And I must say that it was the Spitzer story that got us thinking about even talking about this.
And many others across the nation.
Well, and I'm sure many others across, and I'm sure that you being in New York probably had even talk about saturation coverage on a story. I'm sure that there was even more coverage in New York than the rest of the country.
Yeah, I was traveling in California at the time, but yes, absolutely, yeah.
So I guess I was wondering, just as a way of starting to ask you just what your reaction to the story was, but maybe not so much specifically the story, but the way that it was covered and the fact that now suddenly here it was an opportunity for people to talk about something that probably most of the time is just not a topic of conversation, and maybe it's not something that people really think very much about.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in my experience, having followed this and having studied it for a number of years, it's a topic that sort of weaves its way in and out of the media in different guises, and so is the guys that we saw in the Spitzer case, a sort of high-priced prostitution ring and, this sort of, glamorous netherworld and what's happening there. The other guys that prostitution is sometimes covered in is the trafficking guys, which has been more prevalent in recent years. And so it seems to me that there's kind of an oscillation. So either we're talking about the most desperate and the most exploited, and how does this happen, and what are the global and social forces that that create these situations of desperation, or we're talking about what are the dirty details of powerful men and the women that that they pay to service them, and a kind of more prurient, voyeuristic look at so sort of focusing on two ends of the spectrum. I think unfortunately as a scholar and to some extent now a bit of an activist on these issues, having studied it and bonded with a lot of women who work in the industry, I'm concerned that one of the ways in which it's infrequently covered is from the perspective of the situation of the women who do the work and what their needs are and what their labor conditions are, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess what I think is interesting, and perhaps you could see it somewhat in reaction to this story, but then perhaps maybe in a more general sense in when people talk about prostitution and particularly the question of whether it should be legalized or decriminalized,
right.
it seems that sometimes people are drawing a distinction between two kinds of prostitution as if there was one kind that we had good reason to be worried about, and that would be the kind that it results in sexual enslavement of women.
Right.
And then though, there's the suggestion that, well, perhaps maybe there's another kind of prostitution that shouldn't concern us so much, and that gets us into this question of could we ever regard prostitution as a legitimate career choice, as if that's just another kind of job.
Yeah. I think, based on sort of my experience of studying different corners of the industry for pretty much almost a decade, I mean, I think, certainly there are aspects of this that are, like other kinds, not like any old kind of job, but like other kinds of jobs that require intimate labor. So like therapy or massage work or, the kinds of work that women do in nail salons. There are a lot of people who are paid to do very, very intimate kinds of work that involves bodies and emotions and, kinds of things that not everybody would be comfortable selling, but some people are able to do that. And, in those cases, I do think that criminalization. I would never advocate criminalization. I think I don't think that's ever the right solution for people who are doing the work. But in that case, I think moving closer to a model of regulation that is more similar to other kinds of work would be more apt. Now, in other corners of the industry where exploitation is more prevalent, again, I don't think criminalization of the women or the men in some cases is the appropriate response of society. But I think, certainly of people who are behaving in violent ways or being exploitative in those cases. So, in the United States, everywhere except for a few counties in Nevada, it is a crime both to sell and to buy, although generally it's the sellers who bear the brunt of the criminal justice system. And so that is not an approach which I think serves most of the people in the industry well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that gets a question that I wanted to raise, and that was the consequences here for the providers of the service and the people who are paying for it.
Yeah.
And you can tell me if I somehow miss this, but it seems to me, for example, if we're just going back to the Spitzer story,
yeah,
you could say that the man paid a heavy price, but as I recall the stories I read about this, I don't think that I saw anything about his being charged with a crime. And it may be that there were some criminal charges. I guess my question is, how common it is for the patron, to be charged with a crime, and is it mostly that if anybody's going to be charged with a crime, it's the person who is providing the service?
Yeah, no, it's extremely. You're quite right about that. It's extremely uncommon for the patron to be charged with a crime, especially at this level, and that is what's really important. So there's been this tendency. There's been a trend over the last 10 years in the United States and in other countries, actually, to shift the focus from the seller to the buyer and to implement programs known as John Schools, which are pretrial diversion programs, and which basically involve arresting clients and sending them to something like traffic school to sort of reeducate them out of their purchasing practices. So those programs are becoming more popular and exist in many cities now. And I studied one in depth in San Francisco, but they're here in New York. They're probably in Chicago as well, and many, many other cities in the United Kingdom and in Canada. But what happens in these programs is that, in fact, and this is true, this is something that I'm aware of from my own research and from the research of others that I have read, is that the only men who make it into these programs are men who are the patrons of streetwalkers. So this is the lowest tier of the industry, or the lowest tier of a very, very stratified industry. And so clients who are patrons of escort services, other women and men who work indoors, they never get arrested. They never come under the gaze of the criminal justice system. It would be exceedingly, exceedingly rare. I mean, and so that is another thing about the Spitzer case that makes it so exceptional. Now, I think you're right. I don't think he's been charged with anything. I think that was a threat that they held over him. But, I mean, also, you know, the other thing that's quite remarkable about that case is that, you know, you had the feds going after him and investigating a client. I mean, that never happens. That's just unprecedented is certainly the word.
There's something something strangely funny about drawing parallels between traffic school and John School. At any rate, we have several callers, so obviously this is something people are interested in talking about. So we want to do that. Also, I'd just like to bring folks who are listening here some weather information, because here in our part of the country, we're expecting that today, this morning, this afternoon, tonight could have the possibility of severe weather. And indeed, the National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Vermilion County in east central Illinois, and that will be in effect until noon. Some of the locations impacted include Potomac, Oakwood, Fairmont, Rankin, Ridge Farm, Rossville, Catlin, and Georgetown. Other places also include Danville, Fithian, Hoopston, Sidell, Tilton, and Westville. So, again, if you're in the path of the storm, be aware that you could be in for some damaging winds and lightning, and that you should seek shelter if you're outside. And, of course, stay tuned here to AM 580, because we'll bring you all the details on the weather that we have as they become available. Again, this is a severe thunderstorm warning for Vermilion County, and that will be in effect until noon. And I'd also like to introduce to you again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Elizabeth Bernstein. She is Assistant Professor of Women's Studies and Sociology at Barnard College, Columbia University in New York. She's written a lot about gender and sexuality, and we're talking about prostitution. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll go to a nearby community, Belgium, to start us off here. Line number 4, the toll free line. Hello.
Hello. Since I'm in the way of the storm, I will duck if it comes by.
Okay, good.
I would like to, I don't want to take too much time, but I've got an interesting story for you. Here in Danville. Danville is an infamous community for prostitution. It started off as a railroad community back in the late 1900s, and because of the railroad, had a lot of prostitution. Today, there still is some too, mostly streetwalkers. Back in the old days, they were in houses. Some of the houses were owned by all kinds of people. I happen to be standing in one of them. It's my shop. Now, the gentleman to the north of my shop, his name was Frank Bolin. He built this building in 1915. He was a whoremaster. He was a very, very colorful fellow. Did all kinds of stuff back during Prohibition and stuff. And my next-door neighbor to the south, who has since passed away, his nickname was Ding. And Ding was the bellboy at St. Joseph's Parish, which is farther north. It's now no longer there. It's been torn down. And he would ring the bell when the police came by, so everybody would run. He was in the employ of Frank. Well, as I've traveled around the United States, I mentioned the name Danville to people, and they all get a snicker, because back in World War II, immediately north of Champaign, there was a community called Rantoul, and it was a very large Air Force base called Chanute Air Force Base that trained lots of young men during the Second World War and Korean War. And this place got so notorious that they couldn't come this way anymore, because they had so many problems hauling the guys out of jail or curing them or whatever it may be. But there was enormous stories of just hilarious things would go on, you know, buildings blowing up because they're producing ethanol in the back for drinking, not for fuel. Prostitution has a humorous side to it, as we know, as we giggle every now and again, and then it has a very sad side. The girls today that walk the streets of Danville are addicted to crack, methamphetamine, who knows what, and they're sad people. They truly are sad, sad people, and they're being abused in many ways. But the truly evil person in the whole bunch would be Mr. Bolin. Mr. Bolin is the pimp. The guy that takes the money from a woman who goes out and sells her body to somebody else. How do you do that? How do you convince somebody else to do something for somebody else and then turn around and give you the money for it? I have the hardest time understanding that.
Can I respond?
Well, yeah, do.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for your story. It's very colorful and very interesting, and I just want to get to the sort of emotional heart of it, which is the question you ended up with about pimping, how one can do that, and is this really, you know, is this the definition of evil? I mean, I think you can certainly see it that way, but I guess the question I would pose back, I think this is, you know, definitely reprehensible behavior in many instances, but in other instances it's a bit more complicated. And so the fact that one person takes money from somebody else who's doing hard and, you know, unbelievably hard and, you know, sometimes demeaning, you know, awful kinds of labor, it's not just true, in terms of prostitution in our society. This is capitalism, right? I mean, there are all kinds of industries in which this is true, in which people have to give a cut of their earnings to a manager or a promoter. Now, I think the fact that this is an underground economy and criminalized and, you know, outside the purview of legal regulations and police protection in many instances opens the way up to, you know, often to, you know, greater dangers and greater dangers for exploitation. There are no labor protections. There's nobody monitoring. Think about what would happen in any other industry if there were no laws regulating it and people could do whatever they wanted. You know, gross exploitation would be the likely consequence, and that is what you see often in the street-based sexual economy. Now, it's not the only thing you see. I spent myself 2 years as an ethnographer on the streets of San Francisco and the prostitution strolls there, and there were 4 strolls that I spent a lot of time on pretty much every night, getting to know the women, getting to know their pimps if they had pimps, getting to know their customers. And I would say of those 4 strolls, one stroll, only in one stroll were pimps really a predominant factor. And some of the other strolls, women worked on their own, kept their money, or worked with other women and, worked more informally. Now, you know, legally speaking, some of those relationships where women worked together and shared their money and helped one another out might also be considered pimping, right? Because the definition of pimping is living off the earnings of a prostitute. So I think there's a whole range of behavior that would fall under that definition. And I think some of it is absolutely deplorable, as you suggest, and some of it is maybe a bit more complicated to decipher. Mm.
Just because you have had this the experience of talking with sex workers, I guess I find myself wondering again, you know, often when people think about prostitution, their scenario would be the one that the caller has suggested. And
yeah.
Now the story that we've been talking that sort of started us off, the Spitzer thing, would suggest that that's not the only, you know, as
right,
you say, there's
right.
This is a highly stratified industry. But it leads you to wonder whether, you know, to what extent, if it's even possible, to what extent that you could say that that women or men, it doesn't necessarily have to be women, or men, anyone who would, how many people could actually choose, indeed do choose this, and then at some point they could also choose to leave this this way of making a living?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think, first of all, you know, the first answer I would give to that question is that, look, all of our choices are constrained. I mean, you know, for anybody who has to work, you know, many of us would, you know, even as a professor, there are days when I'd rather be doing something else, and I have a pretty great job. But, I think there's a range here, too. Now, I think, you know, some choices are more constrained than others. That being said, I mean, let me just give you a rough breakdown in a city that I know very well, because my book, Temporarily Yours, was really, I focused on 3 cities, San Francisco, Amsterdam, and Stockholm, but I spent most of my time, most of the research was done in San Francisco. So, on the one hand, we have this image of the brutalized street prostitute. In San Francisco, street prostitution was probably less than 10% of the industry, and most of it, the overwhelming majority, was indoor work, indoor businesses, either of the sort that Spitzer patronized, you know, high-end sort of escort agencies, or people, and this is the sort of new style of working, I think, you know, with the internet and postmodern changes in technology and the economy, people have a cell phone, they get a web page on the internet, they have a, you know, there are a number of different sites where people can post their ads, you know, just like they post personal ads, and many people work that way. And a lot of one of the things that was interesting when I was doing my research for this book is I was doing it during the boom years of the internet economy in the center of the IT industry. In fact, all of these cities were wealthy cities that were booming, and the sex industry was booming too. And in some sense, you would think this is counterintuitive. In these moments of great economic opportunity, why is the sex industry growing, right? I mean, you know, in another moment, feminists would have thought it would wither away in these moments when women theoretically had other choices. Well, one of the things that I found in my research is a lot of these women indeed did have other choices, and they weren't completely desperate. This wasn't their only job possibility. And women and men, I should say, especially in a city like San Francisco or New York or Chicago, you know, something like a third of the industry might actually be male sex workers. So these are people with other options, and yet they were opting for this. Many of them were from middle-class backgrounds, like our Kristen Spitzer sex worker. So why would somebody make this choice? And, you know, I think there are a number of reasons why people do choose it. You know, some of it has to do with sort of shifting definitions of sexuality. The meaning of selling sex, I don't think, is as stigmatizing, as degrading for certain people as it once was, say, 50 years ago. I think for some people it has become a more acceptable choice. I think also even in times of intense boom, and especially for women here, and now I'll focus on that aspect, I mean, I think the fact of the matter is something we can never really bracket is just how well it pays compared to other forms of employment that are available, and that is an incentive, especially in expensive cities where rent is costly, where gentrification is happening. Where else can you get paid $250 an hour, right? Not very many other places. And so I think people do experience themselves as making choices. Now, you know, the array of choices that they have are not infinite, and you know, here I've been focusing on the high end, or we could call it the middle class end, but I think even at the lower end, I think people are often assessing what their different options are. You know, I'm thinking of Erica, a woman who I knew who worked the streets of San Francisco, who would say, you know, that she'd had all these crummy fast food jobs that had paid almost nothing, and she had a kid to support, and this paid the rent, and those jobs didn't. So that, you know, is always, always present when we're talking about prostitution and why people make this choice.
Yeah. We're at about our midpoint here, and I will have other calls I will get to just a second. I do want to reintroduce our guest, Elizabeth Bernstein. She is assistant professor of women's studies and sociology at Barnard College, Columbia University, New York. She writes about gender and sexuality, among other things. Her books include Temporarily Yours, Intimacy, Authenticity, and the Commerce of Sex. She's co-editor of Regulating Sex, the Policies Politics of Intimacy and Identity. Also a book that she's working on now, Creating Modern Day Slavery, The Traffic in Bodies, Desires, and Social Policies at Century's End. And questions are certainly welcome. Maybe just also one more time, I want to mention really quickly that there has been this morning and will be today a chance of severe weather in our listening area. And we do have a severe thunderstorm warning that's in effect for Vermilion County, and that's until noon. We have more weather information to bring to you. We'll do that just as soon as we can. We'll talk next with somebody else who is listening and go to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting subject. You were speaking earlier about, the terms have changed, too, and that you were talking about how it's more acceptable, let's say linguistically, you could say sex worker instead of prostitute, and, you know, the mm-hmm. history,
right,
historical term
right.
of the word prostitute. And I was going to say that on a couple nights ago on BBC Overnight, they had a program about a British program about arresting the clients,
yeah,
prostitutes, and forcing. And part of the thing was to go through a class or some sort of social
right.
thing about how, you know, here's what these women generally are. They're not what you think they are. And they interviewed some guy, you know, anonymously, and he said, well, I didn't know they were this. And I thought, well, give me
yeah.
a break. But I was going to say that your latest book that you're writing on about trafficking, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there seems to be, if you listen to, or read the literature, there seems to be an enormous amount of trafficking in women from, you know, former Eastern European countries, the Balkans and things like that, into Europe and to Italy and stuff, obviously not on their own volition. And I would agree with you that let's say the majority of this was voluntary, like supposedly in Amsterdam and the higher end prostitution, or let's say sex workers in New York, you know, the Spitzer deal, and you've got most of the money and you were the independent contractor, you had your own website. I mean, I guess that's your of your own choice. But I'm always, when I was in the military almost 40 years ago, my recollection of this through the people that utilized these people was just it was not a violence thing, it's more of a domination thing. And, you know, exploiting their weakness.
You're talking about the clients.
Yeah, the clients saying, you know, the language they used to describe me, you know, the thought at post fact was more like the derogatory language used with women, about women, for and of women, was more, and I'm sure it was the youth and the fact that I was in a combat unit and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and all these people were real wired all the time.
Yeah,
or at least we were.
Yeah.
And it just, I mean, I would like to think that this idealization of the Spitzer thing where the girl makes $5,000 for being this incredibly beautiful and, you know, willing partner, and she gets, let's say she gets half of it. I mean, she can retire when she's 25. And I only want to say one thing. Thanks, David, for letting me say this, but there's a film that was made a few years ago called Claire Dolan. I don't know if you ever heard of it or seen it.
No.
It's about a woman who's a high-end $500 a shot prostitute in New York, and very interesting. I thought it was one of the best films about the subject, and all the women I've ever known that have said, see this, they're like, they get all wired and they're upset. But I think it's a very good film, and thanks, David. I appreciate the time.
All right.
Yeah, I just want to make a couple of comments in regard to that feedback, which was very interesting. Couple of things. I mean, first of all, I guess the point that I was struck by was about the clients, and you know, that basically their main interest in being patrons is to dominate the women. And again, I would just really stress that we have to see this as a very, you know, a very, very diverse field. I mean, just people have different reasons, going to restaurants, you know, doing all kinds of things, and that's certainly one segment of it, and I think that segment of it is probably fed and facilitated by the fact that, you know, often women are in working in situations that are disempowering, even if they're not being trafficked or you know, exploited through violence. I mean, they're, you know, they may be, you know, often with military prostitution, they're, you know, maybe very controlled by their employers and so forth. But I just want to also stress that there, you know, is another, not just another end to this, but there, you know, there's a whole, you know, spectrum of reasons and motivations that, you know, men would patronize prostitutes. And one of the things that I did for my book is I also interviewed a lot of clients, so I didn't just spend time with sex workers. I interviewed about 50 clients and then, you know, had sort of countless numbers of informal conversations with others. And, granted, I was looking at another level. I was looking at what I would call this middle tier. You know, I began the show by saying, you know, we have these two poles that are concentrated on in the media often, you know, either the most down and out or the most upscale, but that there's this whole middle zone that nobody really covers or focuses on so much, what I would call sort of middle-class prostitution, which is the focus of my book. And, you know, what I found there with the clients that I interviewed, you know, certainly some were interested in relations of domination with the sex workers, just like, you know, many men are interested in that with, you know, the women in their lives who are unpaid sexual partners. But one of the other things that I found, and I think this was actually probably the most prevalent thing, that at least at this tier, in this population, in this city, that people were purchasing in the commercial sexual transaction was something that I came to call bounded authenticity. So, in fact, what they were looking for was actually not just domination, not just even quick sex, not just an orgasm, but, you know, some kind of an emotional bond. And now this seems counterintuitive. If you would want an emotional bond, why would you pay for it? Why would you have it in the span of a quick date? But in fact, it was authenticity that they were looking for. And, you know, over and over again, men would tell me that I would hear stories from men that, you know, when they would see sex workers They weren't like all the other clients. It was a different kind of experience. They would really know the women's names. They would become friends. There was something really going on here. Now, first, I thought, I sort of raised my eyebrows, like, how could they think this? Because I'd already spoken to so many sex workers who talked about the performative aspects of their work. But, when you hear something over and over again, you realize, okay, this is a sociological phenomenon that we're seeing here. And what was significant to me is that that they believed it to be true. And this said something to me about what their motives were for purchasing sex. And so I think... I think the part that felt authentic, real, emotionally intimate was important, but so was the boundary, and this is what the money provided, right? So the money, one way of thinking about the boundary that money provides, earlier in the show I was talking about other kinds of intimate labor, like therapy, for example, just in the same way that payment seemed to be important in the relationship between therapist and client, so too here. And many people who have maybe seen a psychotherapist at some point would be very dismayed if suddenly their therapist said, I really like you a lot, so you don't have to pay next time. You can come for free. It's the same thing with prostitution. I think people like to pay. I think clients actually feel that they're getting an important boundary by paying, and they're getting this thing that I call bounded authenticity. And the sort of the proof of this was when I spoke to one sex worker named Amanda, who talked about the fact that on occasion she had in the past tried to offer some of her favorite clients freebies or bargain rates, and she found that when she did this, they never came back. They fled. She never saw them again. They were totally freaked out. So you can see some of the relationship between these aspects that I'm talking about here.
Yeah, all right. Very interesting. Let's go on here. Let's talk with somebody, I believe, calling from Peoria on a cell phone, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Mm-hmm. Very interesting show. Just a couple of quick questions. I'll ring off. Touched on it basically a little bit, but I was just wondering, the prevalence of prostitution is so widespread. I mean, there's no secret there. You open up a phone book and escort service or massage, and it's right there. I was wondering if you guys could talk about entrapment and if that's a law that's basically binding the hands of law enforcement, where they actually have to catch the prostitute in the act, because to me prostitution is so prevalent. I mean, you can find it. And I was just wondering also, too, about the influence of the organized crime in the industry, if there's a lot of it, if it's prevalent. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
Yeah. In terms of the entrapment issue, a couple of things about that. I mean, certainly, you're right. You open up any Yellow Pages in a major city, there's 40 pages of ads. And so you ask yourself, how can this be illegal if there's 40 pages of ads? In the Yellow Pages and thousands of ads online with just a few clicks of your mouse pad. So, a couple of things. Another thing that I did for this book is I spent a lot of time with law enforcement watching how they did their prostitution busts, who they went after, how they did these, both with clients, in some cases, and with sex workers. And I would say a couple of things about this. First of all, attention is overwhelmingly focused on the street level part of the sex trade. Now, this has changed somewhat with attention to sex trafficking in recent years, and so now there are some indoor operations that are gathering more attention as well, as people are, especially ones that employ migrants. So that is getting more attention recently, but for a long time, and still, the focus has been on the street level aspects of the sex trade, and I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Now, law enforcement will say, if you ask them that, if you show up with your 40 pages of the Yellow Pages and say, where do you begin, how do you start, who do you go after, what I would hear over and over again is, well, if we get a complaint, I had one person from the Vice Squad explain, look, my job, there's so much of this, my job is to just sort of deal with this in such a way so that my mother doesn't have to see it, right? So they, the most visible parts. And, in some of this, I think, especially in the cities that I was looking at, you know, dovetailed in quite significant ways with, you know, patterns of gentrification that were happening in cities. So, you know, it's no secret, you know, in a city like New York, when Times Square was redeveloped, you know, all the street prostitution that had existed there was moved to the boroughs, you know, and so it's not that there's no street prostitution now, it's just elsewhere in the city. And similarly, in San Francisco, there had been, you know, I don't know, 300 to 400 women a night working in the Tenderloin, and now there's just a handful. And I remember, you know, in the early 2000s, late 1990s, when this shift happened, and a person from the street crimes unit there telling me, look, we've always had the capacity to do this. It's just been a question of incentive. So the police can move it around and get rid of it, and this is often their focus. Now, how they do it is not always with prostitution laws. So when they're focusing on the street, often they'll use things like public nuisance violations, disorderly conduct violations, you know, different kinds of misdemeanors, different kinds of things that will enable them to do street sweeps and to move the women around, basically. And so in San Francisco, I mean, they basically really made a decision to stop using what in California is called the 647B, you know, which is the prostitution statute, and started moving towards using other things which were equally effective. Now, for the indoor parts of the industry, these are applied much less frequently. Now, again, with the attention to trafficking, there is more focus on businesses that employ migrants. Often, you know, so often there will be a bust. Now, in practice, many of these cases don't wind up at the end of the day actually going down as trafficking cases. They might go down as smuggling cases, and you know, and unfortunately for many of the women who work in them, they don't necessarily get the benefits that trafficking victims would be entitled to. Rather, they get deported. So those don't necessarily work so well either. And, you know, in terms of entrapment specifically, I think I don't think that's a big obstacle, at least not in this country. In a country like Sweden, it is. And legally speaking, the police can only make an arrest if they literally catch someone in the act. But in this country, everywhere I've seen this done, it's quite common for an officer to initiate a transaction. And if the sex worker or the client that's being targeted agrees to go along with it and commits what's known as an act of furtherance, either they have condoms in their wallet or they agree to go with the officer to the place that the officer suggests, that's sufficient for making an arrest. And it's quite quick and quite efficient. I mean, I've seen a paddy wagon get filled up with 15 people in 45 minutes. So I don't really think it's a big obstacle here. Now, I don't necessarily think it's effective in the long term. If the goal is to, whether the goal is to eliminate prostitution or the goal is to eliminate those aspects of the sex industry that are exploitative, that are most exploitative and most coercive, I don't think this is, you know, necessarily very effective, because what I saw again and again, especially with the sex workers who were arrested and then would have to spend several hours in jail, is when they came out at the end of the night right back to the strip, and having to work twice as hard and twice as fast and with less safety and discrimination to make up for a night of lost earnings. So then less careful about the clients that they would choose and more desperate.
Yeah. Well, I want to try and get on some other calls, but I guess what strikes me, and I think this is something that you've dealt with in your writing too, at least it's this question that have the efforts that have been waged by law enforcement and government in big cities, if prostitution's not the kind of thing you're ever going to get rid of, what is in fact what they're just doing is getting it off the street, getting it out of the public eye, and in fact, it's been perhaps relocated or repackaged, but it has not been eliminated.
That's correct. That's definitely correct. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and if anything, I think the industry has expanded. It's just, you know, as you said, it's been moved around, and it's been pushed off the street back inside. It's been moved online. It's you know, it's been pushed to these other places and other kinds of social spaces. So, you know, what I suggest in my book, if people are concerned either about the sex industry as a whole or about, eliminating coercion within the sex industry. And so that would be where I fall, because I don't, I do think, as we discussed earlier, that there are people who can do this work safely and in a way that is not damaging to the self. I mean, I've seen many, many instances of this. I think the priority then should be, removing the coercion and making the work safe and making other options available to people who want or need them. And so so one of the things that I suggest is, I think, there's this sort of raging debate amongst academics and scholars and activists, what's the best way? Should it be decriminalized? Should it be legalized? Should it be criminalized? If it's criminalized, who should it be criminalized for? So one of the things that I did for my book, part of the reason I chose the three cities that I did is because each one exemplified a different legal approach to the problem. So in San Francisco, it was technically criminalized, but they were sort of moving towards a decriminalized system for sex workers. In Stockholm, they had moved from a decriminalized system to a unilateral criminalized system only for customers, which is quite interesting and quite innovative, since, as we discussed, usually it's the sex worker who's arrested. Sweden was trying something new, just arresting the client. And in Amsterdam and the Netherlands more generally, they were moving from a decriminalized system to a legalized system, so saying, like, we're going to just treat this, it's a prostitution is a fact of life, and we want to treat it as a business like any other. And so it was interesting to sort of compare these models, right? And so one of the things that was most striking to me on the basis of this research was that in these three cities, at least, which were all similar in size and economic profile, they were all centers of, they were all rapidly gentrifying centers of the high-tech economy when I was doing this research, is how similar, in some sense, they were in effect, that there were the same patterns in all three cities. Prostitution was moving off the street and online, whether it was officially decriminalized, criminalized, or legalized. Street-based sex workers were falling more and more under the purview of the criminal justice system. There was this expanding online and indoor sector. Clients were basically ignored, except for the lowest tier who shopped the streets. And this was very, very striking to me. So what I concluded is that none of these models by itself will make all the difference that we need it to make. Now, I do think that decriminalization is a good start. And just to be clear here, decriminalization as opposed to legalization, decriminalization just means you don't enforce the laws that are on the books, so you don't arrest people for buying and selling sex. But I think that's a good start. I don't necessarily think that is a sufficient endpoint. And I think if our concern is the people in the most desperate corners of the industry, whether it's migrants who are trafficked or very young women on the street who've been coerced into the labor, or people with drug dependencies, or people who are who have turned to this work because of really an absolute lack of other economic options, then those are the issues that we need to address. And so rather than just tinkering with our prostitution laws, we need to think about the broader patterns of political economy that are creating these desperate situations in the first place. So, criminal justice system is just remedial. It's not going to solve the problem. So, for example, if what we're concerned with is trafficked migrants, people who, women in vulnerable situations who take risks that they shouldn't in migrating because their situations at home are so poor or so desperate, then we need to think about what has happened in the world vis-a-vis globalization, certain kinds of international agreements that have made so many people feel so impelled to move, at this moment and to take such great risks, and to think, very seriously and carefully about, policies pertaining to globalization, right, as much as we think about prostitution policy. And, similarly on the domestic front, if what we are concerned about when we think about, like one of the callers was talking about the very desperate women on the street that he was familiar with, think about how people get into these situations so that this would become the only choice. And there was a very interesting study done by a colleague of mine here in New York, in which she interviewed a number of street-based sex workers working in Brooklyn about what their most pressing need was. And they didn't have anything to say about prostitution laws one way or the other. They said what they most needed was housing. So, you know, we need to make sure that we don't have, you know, a completely desperate underclass in this country, in our cities, that has no place to live and no, you know, way of getting food and shelter without turning to work that they might not otherwise do. And I think if we were to address that, then, you know, then the people in the industry would be the people who wanted to be in the industry.
We have about 5 minutes, maybe. We have a couple of callers. We'll try to get one or two. And the time remains. We'll go next to Urbana, line two. Hello.
Good morning, Elizabeth, or at least it's morning here yet for a few minutes. Marriage really is nothing more than a religious property contract. And what is the difference between a one-night property contract and a so-called lifetime property contract? What I think the state needs to do is to get out of the marriage business and recognize only domestic partnerships. Polygamy, polyandry, homosexuality, who cares? If you want to get married, find a church to do it in, and the state will recognize the domestic partnership. Marriage is a religious question. The state has no business in it. Thank you for taking my call, and if you have a comment, I would appreciate it.
Okay, that goes off into a number of different areas. I don't know how you want to respond to that.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, there were two points I think the caller made. You know, what's the difference between marriage and prostitution? It's certainly a question that many sex workers would pose. You know, so he's not the first to pose it, and, you know, many sex workers would certainly agree with him. I think, you know, what underlies that is the point that's true, that, I mean, there are lots of different ways in which sex and money and intimacy and money combine in our society, and many of which we don't necessarily look askance at. So why, you know, why is only this kind of relationship criminalized? I think that's a fair point. In terms of his second prescription for what the state should do vis-a-vis marriage, you know, sure. You know, he was saying that, you know, the state should protect domestic partnerships and that, you know, marriage itself should be a religious ceremony. Yeah, I basically agree with that. I think the state, you know, could recognize any kind of household formation, not necessarily even just between a couple. I have no bone to pick with that. I mean, what he's saying is in line with what a lot of queer theorists in the academy believe. So. Fair enough.
All right, well, let's go to Champagne here for somebody else. This is line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I definitely think that we have to strengthen the bond of marriage and family life in our country, not take it the other way. Therefore, I think the need for street ministry, which is available, should be researched more and more encouraged, because every act, either by the man or the woman, that's done outside of marriage is against the teachings of Christ, and we see it all the way through the Bible that, you know, prostitution is there, and it's never right. And it's weakening our bond within our families with our ability to raise our children, to respect the act of sex as being inside of marriage for the creation of children. And we must promote that in our society, and we must work with our street ministry people and give them help and aid to help these women who have been misled, and also the men who are participating in it. So I hope you can at least hear this comment, because it has not come up.
All right. Well,
very important.
I appreciate the comment. So now we have had in the last two callers, we have had the polar opposites of the way, and I'm sure that there are many people who would line up behind whether one or the other of the two callers and said, yes, that's the way that we should look at it.
No, and I appreciate the second caller, because I think that is that's the answer to the question really posed by the first caller. You know, why does the state care about this so much? Why do people get upset about prostitution? And I think, you know, I think she's right in the sense. I mean, I think it is perceived as being, you know, a threat to marriage and family life. I mean, just a historical point here that I think is worth noting is that, you know, this wasn't, you know, she mentioned the teachings of Christ and so forth, is that this wasn't always the church's position. And, you know, and so, you know, there were many, you know, religious authorities, you know, for many centuries who would argue that, they thought of prostitution as a necessary evil, right? And so that it was actually something that they had to, had to exist in order for marriage to exist. You know, so it was seen as kind of a sort of social sewer in a sense for men's unsavory desires and drives. And you know, even in colonial America, I mean, it wasn't the it was not the sexual issue that most preoccupied religious leaders. Ruth Rosen has a wonderful book about this. I mean, that, you know, it's very interesting when it becomes a social problem. So I don't know that it is something that has always assumed the same prominence amongst Christians or the church that it has now. In colonial America, most church leaders were more concerned about adultery than they were about prostitution. So, you know, so that suggests to me that something else is at play now, beyond religious teachings, that there are other social factors that make this seem more of a problem, like more of a problem now than it once did. Whether to religious folks or secular folks, and my hypothesis about this is that it's growing and diversifying, and beyond that, it's I think a stand-in for a whole host of sexual and cultural changes that are afoot, you know, the so-called culture wars, and so it comes to symbolize the sort of literalization, the crystallization of all kinds of, you know, postmodern cultural and sexual, post-sexual revolution changes that, you know, that many people are uncomfortable with.
Well, you know, if we had more time, we could go into all sorts of directions and talk more about gender relations and labor in today's global economy and so forth. But we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. If you'd like to read more on the subject, you might take a look at the book that our guest, Elizabeth Bernstein, wrote, titled Temporarily Yours, Intimacy, Authenticity, and the Commerce of Sex, published by the University of Chicago Press. Last year, Elizabeth Bernstein is Assistant Professor of Women's Studies and Sociology at Barnard College, Columbia University, New York. Professor Bernstein, thank you very much.
Thank you.